working with. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that? Become yourself. Name God and the devil don't matter. I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb. And you must learn what it means to become responsible. This is an exact science. And that is why you are here.
And the foreknown history. To the unknown future. This is Release Radio. For the seeker.
I must strive to know.
Hello there, welcome back everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik and this is our program, Red Ice Radio. We bring you known and unknown researchers from across many different fields to talk about their work so that you can learn more, get some new ideas, and of course find out what you would like to dig deeper into. If you want to find out more about what we do, check out redicecreations.com, the website where we have much more available for you. Today we're talking with Robert Tindall. He is a writer, classic guitarist, an inveterate traveler whose work explores the crossing of frontiers into other cultures and states of consciousness. He is the author of two books on shamanism, The Jaguar That Roams the Mind and The Shamanic Odyssey, Homer, Tolkien, and The Visionary Experience, along with numerous articles on themes such as pilgrimage along the Camino to Santiago, the medieval quest, the Native American prophetic tradition, and the healing practices of the Vegetalista tradition of the Amazon rainforest. Robert holds two master's degrees, one in English literature and the other in TESOL, that's teaching English to speakers of other languages, and he works as a professor at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco. He and his wife, Susanna, currently lives in Peru. So in this program, Robert is going to discuss the parallels between Western mythologies, such as the Odyssey and the Iliad, with indigenous cosmologies of the rainforest. He points out the shamanic roots of Western mythology and how it has been continued in the work of people like Professor Tolkien. We'll discuss the break from the primal mind into the modern mind. Robert explains its consequences, and he compares this break to the Hopi prophecy of the emergence of two different roads of humanity. Well, something we not hear too often about is the shamanic roots of Western culture or Europe, something that is very accurate in my opinion, and also very neglected at the same time. It's like the people of Europe are not quote-unquote indigenous, but of course they are. Some of the oldest depictions of art, signs of initiatory cults, are to be found in Europe. So this is going to be an interesting program. Welcome, Robert. Thanks for coming on the program. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you for bringing me on.
Oh, you bet. It's going to be very interesting. You have an interesting 2 hours ahead of us talking about your book, The Shamanic Odyssey. Why don't you just tell us about your journey a little bit first here, Robert, before we get into the specifics of the new book.
Sure. Well, we're speaking from Pucallpa, Peru. Or I'm speaking with you from there, which is this cacophonous ecological disaster of a town on the brink of the River Ucayali down here in Peru. And my wife and co-author, Susana Bustos, and I live here in Peru. We've been apprenticing and studying the shamanic traditions of the indigenous and mestizo people here for some years, and made an initial trip down to this area back in 2004 as part of Susana's dissertation research. She wanted to study intense healing experiences in ayahuasca ceremonies that involved ícaros, which are the magic songs sung by the shamans here. And that study ended up leading to a year-long apprenticeship with an Ashaninkan curandero named Juan Flores, who lives in Jucalpa here and has a healing center in the outside of Jucalpa, where there are some remarkable geothermal activity happening out there.
I don't know if it's your first book, but your previous one, The Jaguar That Roams the Mind. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about that briefly.
Yeah. Well, that story began while I was fascinated with medieval quest narratives. Like I had written my master's thesis on the medieval poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And I used that kind of model of the pilgrim or the knight entering into the forest and encountering the wonders there and returning transformed as a kind of basis to tell an account of entering into the shamanic traditions here and kind of crossing over that frontier between what you could call the modern and the primal minds, and experiencing from within an apprenticeship within the Hitalista tradition down here. And it has a lot of ethnography in it. We have more than one informant, but our main teacher was Juan Flores. And it really attempts to tell a good story while also teaching the reader about this vanishing shamanic tradition of the Amazon rainforest. It's in a lot of ways, it's a love song to this culture and tradition.
So you're really interested in the different myths from different cultures, basically comparative mythology. What you've done in the latest book now is obviously compare the record, if you will, of the so-called Western civilization, and also done a comparative study with some of the other traditions. Why don't we talk a little bit about this link and kind of how you got onto this track, Robert?
Sure. Well, it started when we were doing a diet in the rainforest. And a plant diet down here in the Amazon is where you go into isolation and you live in the jungle, and you cut your food intake pretty much down to roast bananas, roast green bananas. You're on a fast, essentially. And you're drinking plants that are known to have certain properties for healing or for apprenticeship purposes. And we were out there for a month in this very rigorous diet. And at one point, our teacher, Juan Flores, came out, and we were seated by the river that was flowing beneath the tambos, or the little huts that we were living in, and we started talking about the mythological beings that live in the waterways of the Amazon. And they're called Yacarunas, Serenas, there's the Yakumama, there's a whole cosmology that the native people have here of these residents that you could call spirits, but they're also quite material at the same time, that live in the waters. And as Flores was describing these the Serenas to us, the parallels with the Serenas in Homer's Odyssey suddenly struck me, because contrary to expectations, Serenas are not nice down here in the Amazon. They will sing songs and draw you into the water. There are abductions that happen of people. They're dangerous. And as I was listening to Juan's story, I thought, gosh, this is just like the account of Odysseus's listening to the sirens, which... in case some of you don't know that story, there's a certain island that Odysseus, in the ancient Greek epic, sails past. And it's known to entrap mariners within the tractor beam of the song of these creatures called sirens that live on it. And the song is so addictive that the sailors will actually leap off the boat and swim to shore enraptured by it, and then they'll lie there and die. They simply, there's like no coming home to the wife and kids. It's all over with. You're caught within their tractor beam. And Odysseus actually voluntarily listens to that song, which is very interesting in itself. But at that time, I was struck by the parallels between these mythological beings. And I asked Juan if he had heard of Homer's Odyssey, and he told me no. And I described the story to him. And at the end, Juan nodded his head and said, yep, that's them all right. So that stayed in my mind. We were in the midst of a pretty intense apprenticeship at that time, and we were filling up notebooks of material. But I kept thinking, how is it possible that in the Odyssey, not only this, but other shamanic features are quite evident once you become familiar with the characteristics of indigenous people and their relationship to a vital, sentient universe. In other words, what we dismiss as animism. And there came a time where I sat down to write a little article about the connection between Homer and these ancient cultures and the indigenous cultures of the Amazon, the mestizo cultures of the Amazon, and the book simply burgeoned. I ended up committed to a whole exploration of these hidden roots, basically, of our own literature and our own culture.
Very interesting. Now, did you study Homer's Odyssey before? Was this just something that you've maybe read in the past in your school days or something like that? Or how involved were you in that at the time?
I had not focused on Homer at the university. My main focus had been on medieval literature. And I wasn't that attracted to the Odyssey before I went to the rainforest. It's curious. I'd read it and it hadn't really affected me, and yet in my years of working with understanding the book and the culture in it, it's become something of a sacred text for me. Deeply, deeply involved in its story, because what we don't realize is that Homer is a comparative modern. He's closer to us in many ways than the original creators of the bardic repertoire that he is communicating. Some of the stories in the Odyssey, you could actually speculate they go all the way back to the Paleolithic cave paintings. They're very, very old.
Yeah.
And these are stories that were passed down by inspired singers and non-inspired singers for centuries and centuries. So it's a deep well of remembrance to spend time with the Odyssey.
Let's talk about you mentioned the origin of the bardic creators. Where does the story come from, do you think?
Which one?
The Odyssey or the Iliad or
it's
all of them, you know?
Okay, yeah. The Iliad, of course, has a historical basis. A war really did happen at Troy. And for me, the Iliad is concerned with very different content than the Odyssey. The Iliad is about the tragic spiral of war and its terrible beauty. It's most akin to Shakespeare's Hamlet in that kind of way, or Othello, possibly, where you feel this buildup of this sublime and terrible vision emerging about the nature of humanity and our relationship with the gods as you read the Odyssey, the Iliad. The Odyssey is very different in character. You know, like one obvious example, if a hero weeps in the Iliad, it's because he's a coward. And yet, in the Odyssey, folks are catharting left and right. There's no shame for Odysseus to writhe on Circe's bed in despair when he learns that he has to go to the land of the dead. He simply cries his eyes out until finally he can't vent anymore. And then he manages to get up and says, Circe, do I have to take this way? There's a very strong presence of female divinity in the Odyssey as well. And one realizes that while the Iliad is pretty focused on Mycenaean civilization, the Odyssey is actually incorporating a lot of material within its story of Odysseus's returning home. It's a nostos, a homecoming song. That's where we get the word nostalgia from, that deep yearning that many of us feel in our souls for a lost home. And the return of Odysseus, for me, it's clearly not a historical chronicle, although in ways it can be treated as that. But fundamentally, it seems to serve more than one purpose. And one of those purposes that I focus on in the book is the negotiation between the emerging modern and the indigenous mind. Because we see that Odysseus has feet in both worlds. He, in many ways, is a quite accomplished shaman, if you're familiar with the characteristics of shamanism. And he's also very much a proto-modern with his individual perspectives and his emerging Greek rationality, his technique, his dependence upon technique, as much as magic. These things are all very significant. So you can kind of look at it this way. If the Iliad is like an archaeological dig where you get down to maybe 1200 BC, the Odyssey is an archaeological dig where you hit the floor in a Paleolithic cave. It's very old, some of the material in there. And it seems to have, at least from my reading, from the perspective that I've developed over the years apprenticing within the shamanic traditions of the rainforest, but also up north. The other major informant for the book is Bob Boyle, who's a roadman in the Native American church. It seems to have some kind of message for our own time.
Can you expand on that? What do you think the message is?
Well, you know, put simply, I think it's that we need to recognize that there was a break between the primal and modern mind, and it was violent. We have lost our sense of a meaningful cosmos and have been inflicting violence upon not only nature, but people of nature, indigenous people whose perceptions are rooted in natural processes and a sense of eternal return. Indigenous people haven't been kicked out of a garden, in other words. The garden is here. This earth is the garden that they were created to live in, and their rhythms are of the earth, and we've been exterminating them for the past 500 years. And I think the Odyssey can help us reckon with our dark inheritance in that way. And it has hope as well in it, because it shows a possibility for reconciliation.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit more what do you think happened? You mentioned the primal and the modern mind pretty much. Are we talking about adaptation of Christianity? Is it religion that comes into the picture? What happened, do you think?
Well, that's something that a lot of people have been working on, and I am not the main person by any means. What put bluntly, Native indigenous people were characterized by a permeable, and are characterized by a permeable type of consciousness, where the boundaries between things is fluid. In fact, what I want to do right now is find a quote of the prehistorian Jean Klotz, who put it much better than I did when he was talking about Paleolithic people. He says, traditional people, and I think the people of the Paleolithic, had very probably two concepts that change our vision of the world. The concept of fluidity and the concept of permeability. Fluidity means the categories that we have, man, woman, horse, tree, etc., can shift. A tree may speak. A man can get transformed into an animal and the other way around, given certain circumstances. The concept of permeability is that there are no barriers, so to speak, between the world where we are and the world of spirits. A shaman, for example, can send his or her spirit to the world of the supernatural or can receive the visit of supernatural spirits. When you put these two concepts together, you realize how different life must have been for those people from the way we live now. And this is the life way still pretty much present down here in the Amazon. You know, the forces of modernity are definitely at work, but when I go out into the rainforest, that's the default setting. And even a moderner such as myself, someone who grew up in the suburbs of North America, can experience that shift of consciousness where you become transformed into a jaguar. And boy, does it feel good. I mean, what a marvelous experience. Or you can become aware of the sentience of nature. For example, there's a river, the geothermically heated river that flows at the center of Flores. I'm just have a dead reckoning that that river is sentient. And it kind of looks over you like a gigantic serpent. And it's possible to have quite meaningful communication with it. I say that even to me, it sounds a little fringy. But this is normal. It's normal for indigenous people. And that's something that we've lost track of.
But this is not a, this haven't been a choice, in my opinion. I mean, animism, as you say, I think this was recurrent among every people way back when in a certain time. But due to, well, what should we call it? Indoctrination, education, etc. A lot of other things were asked to give this up, correct?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, think of the Cartesian model. You have a dead mechanical universe where even animals don't have souls. And the sole bestower of meaning upon experience is your individual little thinking self.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And yet at the same time, then, Robert, we do have these, we do have the carrying on of this type of thinking in a lot of stories that we get, not only going back to Greek mythology, of course, but this idea of all the Therian tropes that exist to a certain extent out there. And we get it from all over the place. So the question again is, have we forgotten it? Have we, you know, kind of turned our back towards it? Or what do you think has happened there?
I think we've repressed it. And by the way, I don't want to be interpreted as dissing modernity.
Right, yeah.
I was just saying Descartes, to have a Cartesian perspective is one perspective of our relationship with the cosmos. It has its certain efficiency, you know. But the problem is it's become the primary mode, and it takes the richness out of life, the beauty out of life, simply on that level alone to believe that you live in a world that's dead and mechanical. There's a kind of deep sadness that one feels in oneself. And I think that that sadness permeates modern culture. On that level alone, the Cartesian inheritance is pretty tinged. It's a mode of perception, but it shouldn't be one that we're limited to. And so I actually think that we can re-educate ourselves to become free from that repressive mode of consciousness, of perception, and to begin embracing the sentience of the cosmos again.
And certainly from my point of view, Robert, I see this kind of organically taking place. There's a lot of people who are beginning to look elsewhere. I think a lot of people have been for a long time. And I think it's, I mean, on the official record, sure, you know, Western civilization is quote-unquote scientific in its orientation. But nonetheless, there's a lot of people who have a deeper understanding and have walked a completely different path than the official one, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and this, of course, is what the book is attempting to contribute, is some kind of foundation, some kind of cultural understanding from which we can understand where we came from, understand that our ancestors were also indigenous, and start honoring them, you know. Our teacher, Bob Boyle, at one point he was reading over my manuscript and he commented that, yeah, we've been dissing our ancestors. You know, we treat Odessi as if he was a kind of embarrassing backwater relative with a lot of funny beliefs. But, you know, he's okay because he's an emerging modern human being. And this is pretty disrespectful to generations and generations of human beings.
Indeed. I mean, Campbell talked about that we lack a mythology in the West, etc. And at the same time that I can agree with this, I also disagree with it, because I see kind of running all alongside Western culture is our storytelling, the way we have you know, movies, even to the modern extent. This is still the old archetypal energies coming through in
sure.
This modern work, right?
And, you know, Campbell actually wasn't saying we don't have a mythology. He was saying it's out of date.
Exactly. That's right. Yes. That's
yeah. Right. He felt that he helped the Mediterranean biblical mythology was woefully inadequate.
Hmm. You know what? There's so many interesting things in the book, and we haven't even kind of finished on the Greek mythology yet. There's so many things there. But you know what? I just want to talk a little bit about Tolkien. I want to bring him into the picture at this point. And get your take on it,
yeah.
And again, see the links, I guess, between the ancient stories and how you view Professor Tolkien's work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was moved to draw Tolkien in because he was the great reintroducer of the mythopoeic imagination back into Western storytelling in the previous century. And that was his express purpose, you know. And there's a lovely quotation of his that I'd like to read you. And it actually happened, believe it or not, on the evening that he converted C.S. Lewis to Christianity. And of course, Lewis's Christianity took off in a direction of Belfast Protestantism that Tolkien found a bit appalling. But anyhow, Tolkien did it in a very interesting way. So I'm going to read a quote here from the book The Inklings of Humphrey Carpenter. And that particular evening, Tolkien says to Lewis, "You look at trees and call them trees. And probably you do not think twice about the word. You call a star, and think nothing more of it. But you must remember that these words, tree, star, were, in their original forms, names given to these objects by people with very different views from yours. To you, a tree is simply a vegetable organism, And a star is simply a ball of inanimate matter moving along a mathematical course. There we have the Cartesian perspective, yeah?
Yeah.
But the first men to talk of trees and stars saw things very differently. To them, the world was alive with mythological beings. They saw the stars as living silver, bursting into flame in answer to the eternal music. They saw the sky as a jeweled tent, and the earth as the womb whence all living things have come. To them, the whole of creation was myth-woven and elf-patterned. And that's the animating spirit of all his work.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the Ents, of course, in the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, Fanghorn was exactly the one that I had in mind as well. These sentient trees that here in the Amazon, you know, when you begin dieting the palos of the various trees like Chihuahuaco and Chichuasi and Lupuna, Ajosquero, many different plants down here, you begin to get to know the individual characters of these trees and to reverence them for their sentience. And you learn songs to them.
Okay, so what would you say then, in a sense, if we talk to a material scientist, let's say, that would you try to explain that the things around us are alive as human beings and animals are alive, or is there something else we can communicate, I guess, to someone to try to kind of get into this mindset of what you're talking about?
Boy, that's a tough one.
Sorry about that.
Does anyone have the answer out there?
Maybe some do, yeah.
Gosh. Yeah. There's a big divorce between these modes of apprehension, for sure. And of course, you know, there's a spectrum of scientists out there. There are those that are the positivists, primarily, who believe that mathematics is the only true way to understand the cosmos, which, by the way, is a purely metaphysical tenet. You know, I sometimes stun my students by saying to them, look, numbers don't exist. Bring me a three.
Yeah.
And they can't believe that they've been believing in numbers all this time. They're metaphysical constructs that are very effective, but they're not real. And I think the greatest obstacle toward really bringing about a synthesis that kind of like, you know, Einstein brought together time and space between indigenous animistic perception, which is holistic, and the bifurcating approach of Western science is in recognizing that they are simply paradigms. They are perspectives, lenses through which we view the world, and one is not better than the other. They simply have their appropriate purposes under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
And in that way, we can, from my perspective, we can start really becoming postmodern, where there's no longer a hegemony of one particular belief system. And science
right.
is a belief system. It's the current orthodoxy. But instead, we can handle these different paradigms with a certain kind of elegance, where we can treat the other inhabitants of this planet with the kind of respect that they deserve.
Well, you know, as I'm listening to what you're talking about here, there's a lot of things that come to me and even potential reasons why things have turned out the way they have. And I think there's, of course, as always, a lot of different elements that are brought together to kind of make this soup combined, of course. But just a simple point as the fact that many in Western culture have moved away from, you know, live foods, if you will, raw foods, the fact that we're eating plant-based or even, you know, animal that is alive. We cook everything to until it's dead and gone pretty much. And I think that partially with many other things is contributing to the fact that there is a kind of a disassociation with the natural world. We lose this idea that There's separation. We lose the contact. We even walk in rubber shoes all day. We don't even have our feet on the actual physical ground anymore to get the grounding that is so essential. And one of the big ones, of course, is also the use of sacraments, right? Entheogens, hallucinogenic plants, etc.
I've started conceiving of these plants as adaptogens. Because I've never, entheogen is very Augustinian in its orientation, revealing the divinity within, which kind of implicitly suggests that the divinity is not without. Psychedelic mind manifesting tends to emphasize, whatever concept of mind you may have. But adaptogen seems to be the way that indigenous people use these plants, such as peyote or ayahuasca. They live in demanding environments, and it's necessary to do some very serious prayer and alignment of yourself with for healing purposes and to get things straight with the ancestors or whatever else may be going on. It's important to be fluid and adaptable in life to walk it well.
Indeed.
Yeah. And so I've really come to view these sacraments as best described as adaptogens.
Adaptogens. Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah. now let's see here. If we go back then a little bit and look at Western culture, if you will, civilization and how it was in the early stages. So if we go back to, you mentioned the Minoans before, we could talk about the cults, if you will, at Crete that allegedly were involved in the honey brews together with other opium type things, and there's at Malta there's the hypogeum where they probably most likely with use of adaptogens, then, as you said, actually used the resonant features of the chambers that they built to kind of enrich their experience, if you will. So it goes alongside for a very long time, as far as we know, in Western culture. But again, then, this is something, what do you think, that it slowly just kind of weans off and is kind of put out of use? Or what do you think happens there at that point?
I don't know. When I discovered the Hopi prophecy that comes from David Mignogni, was shared with the peyote shaman that we work with in the Native American Church, I was very deeply struck, because I think that sometimes indigenous perspectives sort of take in the whole movement of modernity. And we're inside modernity trying to figure it out, but they're like on the outside kind of looking at it. And they seem to have longer time trajectories in certain ways that are really worth considering. And I should also say that there, as far as I know, there is no official Hopi version of the prophecy. It's actually a current that continues to flow, and there's no sort of written official version like you find in the Bible. It's a living current. So the as I was looking at the Cyclops Odysseus encounter in the Odyssey, which is probably the oldest part of the Odyssey, the German philologist Walter Burkert pointed out a long time ago that the Cyclops has a lot of the characteristics of a master of animals divinity. And also the way that Odysseus blinds the Cyclops is he actually fashions a Paleolithic hunting spear on the floor of the cave using a fire, when he has a perfectly suitable sword right at hand to use on the Cyclops. But instead, he goes in for ancient ritual magic. He goes for the Paleolithic hunting spear in order to steal the herd of the Cyclops And that's where Burkert identified the imprint of the master of animals figure, because that's what in more than one traditional indigenous culture the shaman's role was to keep the relationship with the master or mistress of animals flowing so that people could eat. Now, in that scene, it's marvelous what happens, because it shows Odysseus at his absolute worst. He's a completely detestable individual in there. And what we see is the Cyclops as an indigenous person, first being reconnoitered by an invading force. And he is, as was characteristic with European culture from the ancient Greeks, depicted as a monster, half-human, barbarous, not making use of the land, no laws, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Wild beasts. And after the Cyclops is blinded so that Odysseus and his men can rustle the herd and escape, there's a very interesting exchange that happens between the Cyclops. Oh, and by the way, here's another two really interesting features of this story. The first is Odysseus stuns him with powerful drink. Now, that should sound really familiar as a way to render indigenous people helpless.
Right.
And it's not just wine. You know, the ancient Greeks could make wines that were so powerful by putting in plants that were narcotic that this particular wine that Odysseus gave straight to the Cyclops was one that you had to only drink one part to 20 of water.
Mm.
It was so potent. He knocks out the Cyclops with booze. And he rustles the herd. And when they set offshore and they're starting to escape, Polyphemus is taunted by Odysseus. Odysseus calls from offshore saying, "Hey, Cyclops, if anybody asks you who came in and blinded you," and this is the other very interesting teaching point about the story, Odysseus does it not with force but technique, metis. And here's the emerging traction of the individual modern Greek world, you know, separating from nature, using tools, using cunning and technique and a trickery, a kind of dolos, trickery. Now, when Odysseus calls to Polyphemus, he gives his name. He says, "Tell them that it was Odysseus, son of Laertes, who makes his home in Ithaca," and then proceeds to give him his credit card number and his Skype address and his telephone. I mean, you know, everything. Social security number. "You want to know who did it? I'm, you know, this is me." All right? And Polyphemus has a revelation at that moment, because a prophet had been by among his people who told him that he was going to be blinded by some figure called Odysseus. But Polyphemus could not have imagined it was going to be this puny, sniveling little weakling who would do it with trickery. He had expected a warrior. And when Polyphemus gets this news, he goes through a complete review of the significance of what's just happened. And he does something fascinating. He invites Odysseus back to shore to give him a guest gift and to speed him on. Now, usually this is interpreted as a transparent ploy on the part of Polyphemus to get Odysseus to shore and bash his brains out. And but Odysseus' reaction doesn't necessarily support that, nor does Polyphemus' behavior, because Odysseus responds Okay, Polyphemus not only says, I want to give you a guest gift, but also Poseidon, my father, can heal my eye if he wills. And when you start making the connection of, well, Odysseus must go back to shore in order to do some kind of prayer or something, which is necessary to get Poseidon to heal Polyphemus's eye,
mm-hmm.
we realize that the Cyclops is not only inviting Odysseus to come back to heal him out of respect for what he's learned about who this guy is who just visited him, but he's also offering to bless his journey home.
Mm.
So I don't think that the old interpretation of the great dunce, dim-witted Polyphemus attempting to lure Odysseus back holds up. And nor does Odysseus' response support it, because Odysseus says, would that I could pack you down to Hades, you know, before I will do anything to heal your eye.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not precisely that, before your eye is healed. See, the problem is we don't have those connectors, subordinates, and things like that in the language, which show us the relationship between the different things they're saying, right?
Right, yeah.
But the message seems to be reconciliation, putting a blessing on Odysseus's journey, and healing the gouged-out eye of Polyphemus. And if we take the Hopi prophecy, where we see the two different emerging roads of humanity, the one are those that follow the leader of prayer and know they belong to the earth, and the others that pursue a course of individual self-gain and live in a state of spiritual disunity that eventually breaks up, we can see that same kind of juncture in the development of humanity possibly occurring at this stage in the dialogue between the Cyclops and Odysseus.
So you're saying basically that this story is a version and a retelling of the Hopi prophecy?
No, I'm saying that it is an indigenous mythism. In the same kind of way, you can look at the Garden of Eden story as an exile from the primal mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? I mean, there is that layer in it. This is not to say these stories don't have multiple layers, but that is present. You know, you go from hunting to gathering. The only reason people take up agriculture is because they're starving. They're desperate. No one would want to do agriculture, you know, to earn your living by the sweat of your brow. Hunting and gathering, that's the way to go. And so we find that break with the primal mind happening, just the awakening of Adam and Eve in the garden to realizing they're naked. This thing is also figured in the Old Testament, but to go back to the Greek. So what we're seeing, and I'm not saying there's any influence whatsoever between the two cultures here. They're completely distant in space and time. But there seems to be a fundamental insight into the emergence of two roads of humanity. That one that's going into modernity, and which also for the Greek oral tradition, if we take the message as being that, is cursed because of the violence of its rupture with the primal mind.
So all of these different things are connected, obviously, in your view. We're talking about the Paleolithic approach to food and nourishment versus farming. We're also talking about this split or something happening at this point where, well, I mean, if we look at this from the point of view of those who are evolutionary believers, it's almost like we at some point kind of become aware then that we're like alone, if you will, vulnerable. We realize that we don't have sharp, you know, claws and big teeth like all the other animals out there. And we're forced to, kind of cover up. We're forced to develop our wits, our brain, our cunning to survive. So this is connected in some way here.
Well, I'm not so certain. I actually see it more as the loss of symbiosis. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, life has never been peaceful. And we always have to eat.
Yeah, sure.
There's issues of access to water, to, these things have always gone on. And I think that more what these particular stories from this particular time, or this indigenous perspective, to put it better, are looking at is that break between the knowing you belong to the earth, that sense of what John Klotz describes, you know, of the fluidity and the permeability. And also, of course, a sense that, and this is not figured in the behavior of the Cyclops, by the way, but more generally, in a sense of the sacredness of the cosmos. You know, for indigenous people, the world itself, the elements, are sacred. So you can't poison the water if the water for you is the source of life and you reverence it. But with this emerging break between that symbiosis of our own consciousness with the consciousness of the rest of the planet, we begin seeing these problems cropping up, you know, and we get these beautiful artifacts, you know, like Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or Copernican theory, you know, or just, I mean, some really marvelous outcomes in terms of this emerging modern reception. But it's also got the side that we're all aware of, and I think is being most strongly expressed right now by the ecological crises that we're sliding into.
Yeah, so it's within these tools there is a seed for destruction, and again, as everything can be used for good or for bad. And as you say, I mean, I'm on your page with that. There's phenomenal knowledge that have come out of this line of thinking, if you will, as well. I mean, today we're kind of, I'm feeling also we have a going back to source. I mean, today scientists, some anyway, are going so far that they're almost tapping into something which is connecting more with the mystical mind, if you will, that kind of approach. I'm talking about things like quantum physics, for example. There's a lot to be gained in there as well. So we've walked down this path probably for a reason, right, Robert?
Well, I don't know who pre-designed this or if there's a reason. I like to have a kind of similar faith as the Greeks had in the phusis, you know, which is the innate capacity of human beings to heal themselves and find equilibrium, which is why I think these adaptogens are just so valuable for us right now. They're great teachers.
You know what? I want to discuss that a little bit more in the next segment. We're going to take a break here in a few minutes. This is very interesting. A lot of things to weave together here. But it's very interesting. Some new ideas here. We've talked similar lines in previous programs, of course, with the break up the bicameral mind, etc. Things that resonate here quite well. But Robert, why don't we talk about where people can go to buy a copy of the book? Your websites, etc. Give us all the information here.
Well, I'm in Peru right now, so I'm not sending any signed author's copies to anybody. But it's on Amazon. It's everywhere. It's in local bookstores throughout the United States and Europe. Certainly you can get it off of Amazon or Borders or any online source.
Very good. Do you have a personal website, Robert, at this point?
I do. It's called Roaming the Mind, roamingthemind.com.
Roamingthemind.com,
yeah.
Definitely.
And
okay.
It's the blog of my wife and myself. There are things posted primarily about shamanism and cultural phenomenon. I don't know, just whatever really strikes me as interesting. I just wrote a posting on Spirited Away, Hayao Miyazaki's Spirited Away, because there's so much wonderful kind of folkloric elements from the Amazon in it. If you take a look, I mean, he's such a wonderful, wonderful storyteller and filmmaker.
The river that comes in to be cleaned up, right? The spirit of the river goes to the bathhouse.
And the medicine sure. that the river god gives to Sen, you know, just complete, like the best cinematic episode of vomiting ever. You know, the biggest purga that you could imagine.
That's right.
yeah. So, you know, we're really interested in culture. And also we talk about our work there and the journeys that we assist to the Amazon, and healing processes are of real interest to us.
Very good. Roamingthemind.com will get you more information. And again, then of course, the full title for the book is The Shamanic Odyssey, Homer, Tolkien, and the Visionary Experience. We're going to take a short break here. We'll be right back with Robert Tindall. Stay with us. have more radio coming up in the next hour. We'll proceed to talk about the shamanic aspects in the Odyssey, including its references to sacred consciousness-altering plants. And later we talk about J.R.R. Tolkien and what Robert calls the intensified trajectory of consciousness, and he gives us his take on where he sees the current road taking us. We have hundreds of hours of radio on all kinds of different topics available to you as a subscriber to redeyesmembers.com. That's the place to go when you want to hear more. Not only, of course, the continuation of this program, we have all our content archived from 2006 up till today on the website. So why not give yourself a gift of extraordinary explorations into the wonderful and bizarre, many of the things that, as you know, most people have no clue about. And by the way, we have coming up later on the program, Russell Targ, part two with Ulla Damegård and Randall Carlson, among others, next. Stay tuned. You can subscribe to our RSS feeds, of course. But we'll proceed right now with the next hour with Robert Tindall. Thank you for listening.